This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, our series on homelessness in Greater Hartford continues with Susan Campbell. We will catch up on the struggle of Sal Pinna to find a place to call home. But first, we recently did a show about a proposal by the Malloy administration to create a quasi-public transit corridor development authority. It would be a way for the state to help towns and cities develop properties around transit hubs. The original bill was controversial because it included language about eminent domain, which was later taken out of the legislation. Supporters of this bill got in touch with us saying, we weren't giving the full story, that an authority like this would be a boon to regions that need to start thinking about transit-oriented development. So we're revisiting this conversation, and we'd like to hear from you. Join us, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us from our New Haven studios is Astris Farwell, who's president of the New Haven Urban Design League. And welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'd also like to welcome in Rick Dunn, who's executive director of the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments. And Rick, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me, John.
And Rick, we're going to start with you. So maybe, first of all, let's get an update on where we are with this proposed Transit Corridor Development Authority. The legislation has been through a few different pieces of process work. Where does it stand right now?
Well, the bill was passed as a substitute by the Planning and Development Committee. It was moved on to the Legislative Commissioner's Office. It's being drafted as a file. It may even be released today. The notes from the Office of Fiscal Analysis and the Office of Legislative Research are being drafted.
Okay, so in your mind, what would this do if we have this Transit Corridor Development Authority created? What happens next?
Well, the ability to create a tool that municipalities can use to develop areas around transit hubs to create more activity and the types of development that particularly young adults seem to want is important. Towns don't have the types of financing options and really, in many cases, the expertise to deal with brownfields, to deal with the types of issues that exist around what is really robust infrastructure that's underutilized. The taxpayers have paid for it over the years. They're not getting best use out of it, and they've been letting developers build sprawling developments outside of their downtowns where the taxpayers eventually inherit that infrastructure and have to maintain that.
So this authority allows towns and cities to be able to develop in a smart way and be able to finance some of this work in a way that is not previously available. Maybe you can just explain exactly how that works, because you're part of councils of governments. There are
sure.
regional organizations that do planning around the state. So maybe you can tell us how this all would fit together in your mind.
Well, the inability of local municipalities to develop the financial resources in particular to do projects like this is severe in Connecticut. There is not a lot of taxing authority that's been devolved from the state. The state controls most everything except the property tax. Property tax is a truly unfair way to try and raise this revenue and pay for infrastructure that has a statewide benefit.
I think we can all agree with that, yes.
Yeah. So I think that the ability to issue revenue bonds, and it's important to note that Transit Corridor Development Authority is not issuing debt at the general obligation debt that is the responsibility of the taxpayers of Connecticut. They will sell bonds, revenue bonds, for the development. The work will primarily be done, I would expect, by private developers. And the bond holders are really at risk for the investment. So they won't buy the bonds if it's not a good deal, if it doesn't pencil out.
So one of the things we talked about when we last visited this that some municipal leaders are concerned about is actually flipping this entire idea on its head. You're essentially saying some of the municipalities you're working with would like the opportunity to work with the state to find funding to do projects. Some municipal leaders say, look, that's fine, but we're worried about the state coming in, essentially bigfooting us on projects that they want to do in our town and telling us what to do. Connecticut, of course, as we know, has a very strong history of home rule. So address that concern, if you would.
Sure. TCDA bill is actually a better instrument for them and should give them more comfort for communities who want this. And that's the important thing. Communities have to want this. But when as opposed to the current situation, the Connecticut Department of Transportation has the ability to exercise eminent domain today. Not for a half mile, not for any specified distance. They can come in and take what they want today. State Hospital Corp. They want to build a hospital in downtown Stamford. They can do that. They can take 20, 30 acres. So I think that this bill, and why some of the opposition caught some of us by surprise, eminent domain is really a red herring in this bill, and I think that's why they took it out. Frankly, I don't know that it was the right idea. I think towns are safer with the TCDA and the requirement that there's be an agreed upon plan between the municipality and that TCDA has to be invited in by the local municipality.
So they'd have to be invited in by the local municipality, but the decision-making process, the board that is created for this TCDA, it doesn't necessarily involve or have on it people from the local community. The people from the local community are in an advice and consent role. Mm-hmm. They certainly can say, here's what we'd like to do. But at the end of the day, if the state wants to do something, the state would do something.
Well, the bill doesn't create any exemptions from zoning or from any other local regulation on private development. So the law hasn't changed really at all in that regard. Insofar as the authorities, project committees, the mayor or the chief elected official of the municipality is now the voting member along with the authority members and the local regional planning director, executive director of the COG, has a non-voting role on that. I think there's adequate protection, certainly stronger protections than exist under current law if the state wants to do a project.
We're talking with Rick Dunn from the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments, and we're talking about this bill that we spoke about a few weeks ago. It has to do with transit-oriented development in the state. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I want to go to Enstris Farwell now from New Haven Urban Design League just to get your take on this bill, what you think the benefits might be, what you think some of your concerns are.
It is a very important bill, and I support the goals of it. I think that the bill still needs some work on it. It's important to places like New Haven, which are very small in their land mass, and we really do need to find ways to use our land more efficiently and to build around transit. Our train station continues to be improved in a major part of our city. But we need to really develop standards about what TOD, transit-oriented development, really is in New Haven and in each different town that this will affect. One of my concerns when I read the bill is that there's a great deal of discussion about general development and parking and parking rates, but I don't see a lot of transit in this transit bill. So, for instance, there's no mention in the bill at all about, for instance, buses and streetcars and how you would evaluate different proposals for projects, develop a metric, for instance, for thinking through whether you're spending $30 million on a parking garage or whether you can invest in actual transit improvements in a city like New Haven. I'm also concerned about the structure of the board. It has 11 members, and three are appointed by the Connecticut General Assembly, and the rest are appointed by the governor. And included in the eight that are appointed by the governor would be four commissioners, state employees. And I think that that could create a conflict of interest, that it would be better to have people that are not state employees serve on this very, very important commission.
Rick, what do you say to that? I mean, we talked a little bit about the makeup of this board. Do you think that if there was a little bit more diffusion of the power on this board, that maybe it would, in the end, make for a better overall system?
With all respect to answers, I'm not certain that that is the makeup currently in the current draft. It could be. I'm not sure that there are many employees involved. I think what's important to remember about the authority is that it is going to be making decisions about issuing debt. It is going to be making decisions about entering into development agreements with outside parties on a much larger basis than the individual town project. The town project and the control that towns exercise over development projects in their communities, I think it remains largely the same under this bill. So I'm not as concerned. There's a voice on the local committee for a voting voice for the mayor or chief elected official, and there's certainly input. But there's going to be plenty of public input. I would concede to Anstris that there's always risk in new projects, and many times projects don't turn out to be what you would like them to be, and that's regardless of whether it's sponsored by the state or facilitated by a development authority, private development. You know, one of the risks and one of the reasons I like this bill is towns currently have to do one of two things to take on these developments. They either have to issue debt themselves, which is really not a good solution when we're talking about, and we haven't talked about why this is important statewide, why it's important for economic development throughout Connecticut, and why everyone has an interest in it. But I think that it's one of the considerations that we have to make in this. But the local control is largely the same. I'm not too worried about it. I don't see the risks any different.
Well, I'll just ask you, why is it important for statewide development? Maybe you can use the Naugatuck Valley as an example. So let's get to some specific examples. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. How would this help the towns up and down the Naugatuck Valley and help knit that to an overall statewide transportation strategy?
Well, the Naugatuck Valley, as you know, is served by the Waterbury Branch Line of Metro North Rail. It has not been, in terms of service, there has not been great investment in it over the years. Ridership has diminished. The rail administration, interestingly, added a rush hour train in the morning, peak train in the morning, that made good connections quickly all the way to Grand Central. Ridership on the line increased by 300% immediately. So towns saw this. They've looked at their downtowns. I often refer to the Naugatuck Valley downtowns as 19th century TOD, denser development, walking distance to transit hubs. Of course, the trolley cars are gone, but rail is still largely there. The highway systems are overburdened tremendously. You know, and if I might, the state will be facing choices on corridors like Route 8. There's a bridge that crosses the Housatonic River between Derby and Shelton. It is operating at probably double or more than double its capacity at peak hours. And that bridge will cost billions to replace. Now, the question is, do we spend maybe a half billion of state money on the rail line? Do we encourage transit corridor developments around the hubs to make those things happen? Or do we spend $2 billion on a bridge replacement just for the capacity of motor vehicles, which by the way, is the worst return on investment, is building highways. The taxpayers lose out in almost every way. In terms of the towns and what they can do and why this is important, you know, I was involved in a former career. I was an economic developer for the city of Derby. We designed a redevelopment zone. We tried to use the statutes as best we could. We entered into an agreement with a preferred redeveloper. And what happened in the delays and some of the machinations of the private developer was that the great buildings that form the urban wall on the south side of Main Street are gone. They were ordered demolished, in fact, by the state building official because they were crumbling. So there's a big open 12-acre space adjacent to the train station. Behind the train station, there's a 28-acre space that the state and the federal government have already invested in bringing infrastructure into. But there are brownfields around the factories that once existed in these areas. There's a large investment to make the land development costs competitive with greenfields. And I think that that's where they need help. That's why they want to take it on. And it, frankly, when you have a 24-hour downtown or an 18-hour downtown, that's what rejuvenates a community.
So interesting. Let's talk about that. What needs to get built around some of these transit hubs if we have situations in the Naugatuck Valley, say, where some poor planning in the past has led to big vacant lots right next to the train station? What would you envision as the thing that this transit-oriented development authority would do that would make things better for the state, knit together better a transportation strategy for Connecticut.
Well, I agree with Rick Dunn about, in a way, we're trying to rebuild some aspects of our 19th century cities, which were naturally transit-oriented. A train station was a place that was served by streetcars and trolleys and some private vehicles dropping people off, but it wasn't a place that was surrounded, for instance, by parking garages. And I worked years ago in Derby for the regional planning office, and it's such a tragedy what happened there, and it's so important to, in fact, have an authority like this so you can rebuild in a way that recreates a walkable city. I think that one of the basic metrics that needs to be looked at is, can you walk to the train station, and what's the nature of the development within a quarter mile of it? One of the essential things about walkability, and it's a core part of transit-oriented development, is that you have relatively small blocks, so it's easy for people to navigate the shortest possible route to their destination. And then after that, when you get to the half-mile range, to be investing in grid structures that also support bus or streetcar routes in a very efficient way. So it is one of the weaknesses that I see in the bill as it's currently written, that there isn't a very strong definition of TOD. It's really is describing focusing development near a train station, but not articulating the principles that will get us to exactly where we need to go. So I do think it's a very important bill, and it needs revision. It isn't something that I would say that I'm discounting. Another important metric that isn't mentioned in the bill, some very good changes have happened. There are some good revisions. There's no mention about environmental considerations, and because one of the major benefits of transit-oriented development is, in fact, taking cars off the road and providing really viable alternatives so that people in Connecticut have a choice about how to move around, there's nothing that helps, for instance, compare, would one state investment help clean up air quality versus another one? So I think that that would be another thing to look at in how you formulate the policy and values that this bill is looking to support.
I have to take a break here in a moment. Just, Rick Dunn, very quickly, if you would. Do you believe that we need to, in this bill or legislation like this, better define exactly what we're talking about? When we say transit-oriented development, it can mean a lot of things. Development is many things. Do you think we need a better definition?
Not necessarily, but I think we need to talk about how we got to where we are with this definition and talk a little more about what we mean about TOD in Connecticut.
So when we come back, let's do some of that. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking with Rick Dunn and Anstris Farwell. We're talking about transit-oriented development in Connecticut and a bill that might help towns and cities, regions develop a bit better around their transit hubs. You can always tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We've been talking on the show about Governor Malloy's plan moving through the state legislature to create a transit corridor development authority. The bill was referred to the Office of Legislative Research and the Office of Fiscal Analysis. It's raised questions about how development that supports public transportation might happen better in our state. You can always join us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're joined by Rick Dunn, Executive Director of the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments, and Anstris Farwell, the President of New Haven Urban Design League. We were talking about the definitions of transit-oriented development. Anstris, I'll ask you to do this first and then to Rick. When we talk about this, I mean, we've done plenty of programs, but everyone, I think, has a different definition. What do you see as the most beneficial definition of transit-oriented development?
Classic one, particularly for cities of the size of New Haven, is that it's a place where you can walk to transit. So that's the primary relationship.
I'm just going to stop you, meaning you can live there and walk to transit, or you work there and walk to transit, you can shop there. I mean, what's the mix?
All of the above. So, but primarily a place to live. We really want to develop communities, not simply developments. And so I think that is a core value of transit-oriented development. It isn't just shifting people all over the state, but as much as possible to make an area around a transit hub convenient for people who live there that want to take the train, for instance, to a job or to locate a business near the place where they live, but have that business have the advantage of easy mobility to visit, for instance, other businesses that they're working with. So, but it's physical planning and really community planning, not simply, it isn't, for instance, like building a single-use central business district. These are truly mixed-use zones.
Mm-hmm. Rick, how about you? I mean, give me your classic definition or the definition you'd like to apply to this.
Well, I should start by saying I agree with what Anstruther has said. I think that applies to New Haven. It could apply to Hartford. It probably applies to Bridgeport. The problem with the definition of TOD in Connecticut is we have to deal with what we've created in a certain respect. We struggled with the definition several years ago when we actually created the statute for TOD and what it would mean. More classically, I think TOD developments are considered to be a quarter mile walking distance of the transit hub. We adopted a half mile in Connecticut because we had transit systems that were in downtowns where it was considered to be walkable within a half a mile. That's how we got to that definition. I want to address parking because this is always a bone of contention with transit-oriented development. I probably should say that I truly don't believe what we have or have the primary ability to develop in Connecticut is transit-oriented development. We have something called transit-adjacent development opportunities. So parking. Classically, you would not put a parking structure in a TOD district. But we need to move people in their cars from these sprawling communities in the suburbs to transit hubs to get them in on a train as quickly as possible. The major problem that we have in the Naugatuck Valley is that many people work at the ends. They work in Waterbury or they work in Fairfield County, Stamford, Norwalk, Fairfield, and onward. Those people right now drive to mainline stations, Stratford, Milford, New Haven. They park their car there. They get on the train and they go. I think the trick here is to create TOD developments along the branch lines inland where we can create shorter motor vehicle commutes for people who live in the suburbs. But we need to provide them a place to park within the TOD development. We're going to have to hide it. It's not a perfect solution. And it's not true TOD. You know, it's interesting. Dr. Cog, which is our counterpart in the Denver Regional Council of Governments.
Dr. Cog,
Dr. Cog, yeah, it's great.
Superhero. Yeah.
They went through this. They increased a regional sales tax increment of a quarter cent. They built $4 billion of infrastructure, almost all transit-oriented development. And in a true TOD, you run the light rail, the commuter rail, or trolleys down the center. And all of the housing, all of the uses face the transit. And behind it is the non-transit uses so that it's all walkable. It's not being impeded upon by motor vehicles. That was something that is probably not likely given Connecticut's current state of build-out. Now, it's possible. If New Haven wants to take on a project like that, they can certainly do that. And I think that the Transit Corridor Development Authority bill supports that and creates conditions for New Haven to do something like that. You know, other cities, they don't have to do this. I don't think this bill was created really for the Stamfords of the world. You have a mature market. Stamford could be more walkable to transit.
But if it's not created for the Stamfords of the world and it's maybe created for the Naugatucks of the world, the question is, if it's not really true transit-oriented development that we're talking about, meaning that one of the things you have to build is a parking facility adjacent to the transit hub, I mean, we are defining transit-oriented development quite a bit differently than the classical definition or even the standard definition that we're trying to go with now. I mean, frankly, what's the point of it? We're actually doing something different than what we're supposed to be doing. I think to Anstruther's point, we're incentivizing behavior that will keep people in their cars on the highways so that we will have to rebuild that bridge between Derby and Shelton over and over again.
No, I disagree. I think the opportunity exists to create dense developments around transit hubs where people can live and work and won't need a motor vehicle. But by the same token, we have to get those people who are already in the suburbs and work elsewhere on a train, and we want to do it at a shorter distance. We don't want them driving as far to do it.
And so let's talk about that balance, because I think you know there's that is really the struggle of Connecticut, right? Because of the way we've been built and developed in the past, we still have to deal with the fact that we've got people living out in these greenfield suburbs that still need to get into transit hubs, and we need to get them in the habit of using it. How do we strike that balance? We just can't say no parking, because then we might not have people using the trains.
Well, I'd like to look at, how do you actually create another option for people, let's say, that live in the Derby-Naugatuck area that want to live there but are commuting down, let's say, to Stamford or New York? Can they live closer to the train station, create that as an option? And the other problem in this is that there are many people that are living in the suburbs that are not looking to use the train station to go to work. They're driving to Sikorsky, for instance. So you may have to repair that bridge anyway. So I'd look at really trying to create true TOD for the people that are ready to make a change rather than do a mixed system like transit adjacent development. Because then you're not doing either thing in any effective way. I'd like to just add one other thought. One of the other concerns I have about the bill is that its purpose is stated very, very simply as being economic development. And I think as this bill continues to be drafted, it would be important to define what economic development is. There's all kinds of things that can truly be said to be economic development, but it may not be what either the town or cities or state actually means in this statement. We need to know who is the economic development for. Is it focused on a statewide benefit, on a local benefit, on a particular community benefit? So I think that that's something that needs a little bit more work in the bill as well.
I think that that's an important key here. If the state, Rick, is helping to develop around these transit hubs, and the transit hubs essentially have already been codified as an economic development tool, right? You've got a train running right through your town. It's going to stop there. People can get off and do things. If the state helps to develop in a half mile around it, you know, one way to look at it is we're going to build housing that will get as many people on that train as possible, all the things that TOD is supposed to do. Another way to look at it is we're going to build stuff that's going to make money for the state in that quarter mile or that half mile because, well, look, it's about economic development. It's not about TOD.
Well, the state is not in business. The state shouldn't be in business. I think the Corridor Development Authority is the reason that it demonstrates why the state is not in business and doesn't want to be. We don't want DOT doing this. We don't want DOT developing the exterior components, the housing components, the office components, arts and culture, which this bill also charges as a primary goal. This really allows us to develop communities in the way they need to be developed. The definition of economic development, you know, it really depends on where you come at this from. Same as transit. My mantra is that in Connecticut, given the situation we're in, transit is economic development. We need to be able to move people between where they live and where they work, and we need to create places that are more efficient in carrying that out. So putting them in, attracting people to more dense developments in urban centers is really a goal, because we haven't done a good job at this. I have friends who work in Stanford, much younger than myself. They've chosen to live in Brooklyn and commute to Stanford, and their cars are sitting in their company parking lots in Stanford, rarely used. It says that we've done something wrong. You know, in the last recession, I think it was a 41% drop in residential values. But transit-oriented residential values actually held stable and are and have increased more quickly.
But I think to answer this point, just so that we are a little bit more clear, we can say that any transit development is economic development, and I think we all agree in this conversation certainly that that's a good thing. But really, where the dollars are supposed to flow, is it about an overall statewide economic development plan, or is it about that particular community and doing something for that community that makes sense from an economic development standpoint?
Yeah, I don't think it's either or. You have to. It has to be a cooperative effort. I mean, towns have to want this, but the state's future is truly at stake. We've lost population. We're losing our young people. We're losing jobs. I mean, Connecticut's competitive position for retaining and attracting business is not the strongest. There are a couple of reasons for that, but one of them is transportation. If a business is looking to locate in Connecticut to create jobs, to create economic value, if you're against creating economic value, and if that's not your primary goal for the state of Connecticut, then I'm having a different conversation than those people are having.
Anstris, before we run out of time, I'd just like to ask you about how you feel New Haven itself is doing around the issue of transit-oriented development. Obviously, we've seen quite a bit of interesting work around a news station that's right next to a huge housing development and shopping development. But then there's also still problems with the main train station in New Haven being somewhat divorced and disconnected from the rest of the town. How do you think New Haven's doing?
Well, there are many studies and many committees. I'm serving on one that's looking at how to create transit-oriented development in an area that is about a half mile away from Union Station and within a quarter mile of the State Street Station. There still, in New Haven, is not a definition of TOD. So that's something that we need to work on, too, to really define what it is exactly for New Haven. So I agree with Rick Dunn that in all of our different towns, TOD is going to be somewhat different. And it's important to come up with an appropriate definition. Some of the developments that have been sketched out at this point actually are things like giant apartment blocks for young people, primarily, that have huge amounts of parking. So you could have someone leaving a car all day to jump on the train to go to work somewhere else, and in a way, taking up and wasting a great deal of valuable land near our train station. There is a very good plan that's moving through approval now. It's called the Hill to Downtown Plan. It was funded by HUD, and they were looking, some of the most successful parts of this plan are the study of scale relationships between different uses in different areas around the train station. What needs continuing work on it is, in fact, the street grid itself is very unresolved and not meant to be resolved in this plan. It's a next step. But what has been drawn, in fact, are in many places super blocks with giant parking structures in the middle of them. And so even that really isn't transit oriented. It isn't walkable. But there's recognition of this and discussion of it. It is basically a very big step forward in thinking. And it's allowed a good discussion. So I do see some very excellent things happening in New Haven.
I do want to thank you for being part of the discussion today. Anstris Farwell, president of the New Haven Urban Design League, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank Rick Dunn, who's executive director of the Naugatuck Valley Council of Governments, for coming in and talking through some of these issues. It's important stuff, and I really appreciate you coming in and chatting with us, Rick.
Thank you for inviting me, John. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll check in with Susan Campbell and hear how a local homeless man is doing as he searches for permanent housing. It's part of a challenge to end chronic homelessness in the greater Hartford area. We'll catch up on that story. Coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, you think of beavers as being the master builders of the animal kingdom, but what about the tiny birds that can turn thousands of twigs and scraps into intricate nests that weigh hundreds of pounds? We'll talk to a local filmmaker about her new nature series on animal homes, and we'll consider the fascinating and increasingly threatened horseshoe crab. It's an amazing Animal Friday on the next Where We Live. Coming up next, we're going to take a look back at a story that we've been following with Susan Campbell. She's been reporting for us on the 100-day challenge to greatly decrease chronic homelessness in Connecticut. People who are chronically homeless have been off the grid sometimes for decades. So far, the team of people working on this problem say they've officially housed 8 people and conditionally matched 27 others with housing. The goal is 100 people housed by the challenge's end in June. In a moment, Susan will be here to give us more of an update on the challenge, but first an update on the man whose story she's been following, a man named Salvatore Pinna.
I didn't think the story would end this way. Sal Pinna has been homeless for 20 years, since he came to Connecticut from his native Long Island to enroll in a substance abuse program. Pinna is a 52-year-old man who loves the Mets, Batman, and Dean Martin. He wants a home, but the myriad forms and appointments that are required have proven to be beyond him. Pinna has diabetes, and he's been diagnosed with depression. And a few years ago, this.
And the doctor came up to me, one of the doctors came up to me and says, "Mr. Pinna, I hope you know that you're diagnosed with bipolar." I says, "Oh, what else is new?"
These last few weeks have been particularly challenging. On March 31st, Hartford's No Freeze shelter, where Pinna was staying, closed, and Pinna and 49 other people were out on the streets. Some of those 50 men found shelter beds, but not Pinna. He moved instead to a spot in Hartford to sleep rough. He said he was staying
someplace safe. Let's put it this way.
Why won't you tell me exactly where?
I don't want nobody to know. I don't even want to. Let's put it this way. Like I said, I don't want nobody to know.
Despite the obvious dangers of sleeping outside, Pinna was dismissive of his situation.
Nothing new to me.
And you've been able to stay warm?
I've been able to stay. I got this thing.
What's this thing?
Sleeping bag.
But over the next few days, Pinna was starting to suffer. He visited soup kitchens for 2 meals a day, and symptoms from his diabetes kicked in. He had nightmares, and any attempt to get a shelter bed ended in disappointment. He blamed favoritism, that people were being housed ahead of him.
They told me that every place is filled up. And I'm thinking to myself, how could that be possible?
In fact, it wasn't possible. There were shelter beds available and even shelter staff on the lookout for him. But this is part of the challenge of housing someone like Pinna. Accessing a shelter bed meant he had to show up at particular times, and that sometimes proved beyond him. Forms confuse him. Earlier, during a long slog trying to get a replacement Social Security card, at least once he went to a downtown office, saw a long line, and left. But in his mind, that brief encounter counted as visiting the office. Over the next few days, Pinna's generally indomitable spirit began to flag. He talked about how other people viewed him.
I've heard people say to me, "Who's this bum? Who's this lowlife?" I mean, I'm a human being just like they are, but I got something happened to me. That's all there is to it. That's all I can say. I could have been housed years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Earlier, Pinna was given a vulnerability test that assigned to him a 2. The higher the number, 20's the highest, the greater the likelihood that housing would be found quicker. Just for comparison's sake, I took the same test and scored a 4. By that measure, my vulnerability is greater than Pinna's. The vulnerability test is just one measure by which people can be housed, but it's a big one. And the variation of scores points out another challenge of a system that's meant to put people in permanent housing with supportive services as necessary. The system as it exists is far from consumer-friendly, and part of the 100-day challenge is devoted to building a new system that works for the people it's supposed to serve. The irony here is that the place Sal slept recently, when he was sleeping outdoors, was within sight of the statehouse in Hartford.
Nobody else around me but me.
And you feel safe?
I feel safe.
At one point, Pinna got into a downtown altercation with Hartford police, but a friend of his interrupted to tell the officer that Pinna is homeless and dealing with developmental issues. The officer gave the friend his card and said he would look out for him. That brief encounter with the police cost money. Taxpayers pay for every interaction with a person who is homeless. Insurance premiums pay for health care of people who are homeless and have no alternative but the emergency departments. Keeping Pinna on the streets costs far more money than getting him housed. Except for that one act of a police officer's kindness, it looked like everything was spiraling downward, and I worried that I would have to report Pinna's death.
How have I kept going, day by day?
But then the efforts of several people working on the 100-day challenge paid off. Pinna's name appeared on a list at a housing meeting last Wednesday, and from there, things moved quickly. In last Friday's cold morning mist, we met at Charter Oak Cultural Center. I asked him what permanent housing would mean to him.
Let's put it this way. It would put an end to a 20-year nightmare.
And then this happened. Sarah Simonelli of Chrysalis Center walked up and introduced herself to Pinna. Chrysalis Center has a program, Cooperative Agreement to Benefit Homeless Individuals, that provides intensive case management to people like Pinna. Simonelli offered Pinna a berth in the program, which means for 9 months he would have someone walking him through all kinds of services he desperately needs. Pinna sat quietly, and then she said this.
And then the second thing is we have a subsidized housing voucher for you, so we can get you into an apartment. And with that, we can start looking as soon as you want, even today.
I do it today.
Yeah.
I do it as soon as I can. I do it right now if I had the opportunity. The sooner the better.
Though his reaction to the news was muted, inside the classroom, Pinna acknowledged that this was huge.
I feel a little bit better.
You'll feel better when you walk in.
I'll feel...
When you have the keys in your
hand. I'll feel 10 times better when I have a key to my own place in my hand.
And then, just before class started, Pinna sat looking at the floor and munching a Pop-Tart someone gave him for breakfast. He said quietly, so quietly I had to ask him to repeat himself, "I need to hug somebody." He has been looking at apartments this week. The goal of the 100-day challenge in Hartford is to house 100 people who are chronically homeless by the campaign's end in June. That's 99 more Sal Pinnas in apartments, receiving services they need, working jobs they want, and already planning, as is Pinna, the first Italian meal he's going to cook for his friends in his brand new home.
That's Susan Campbell reporting. Susan joins us in studio now. I'm glad to get some good news on Sal, Susan.
Me too. Very, very glad.
Yeah. And so where are we right now? I mean, even since we did this reporting, do we have more updates?
We have that Sal is meeting Sarah Simonelli this morning. I'm going to go out with them after the show, and they're going to be looking at apartments. And there are people who are putting household goods aside because he's going to move into an apartment with nothing, although Cabby does give a stipend, so he'll have money for some furniture and some household goods. Mm-hmm. But he's starting from scratch except for the bag he carries.
Nathan Fox joins us. He's director of Outreach Ministries at Center Church in Hartford. Nate, good to see you. How did Sal's story go from so hopeless, seemingly, to promising now?
I think Susan really helped drive the process in that we were... So we've been going through this process of trying to identify people who are in need. And I think that Sal's point is real in some sense in the looking at favoritism. And Sal is not someone who puts himself out there naturally. And so he kind of fell off the radar. I've known Sal for 4 years and he's been homeless for 20 years. And yet it still took me like a month to think, oh, yeah, I need to go and do these assessments for Sal. Once that was sort of pushed in our direction, we quickly got those different forms completed and we were able to see where the gaps were. We saw that his VI-SPADAT score, the score that Susan referenced in her story.
This is the score where Susan actually scored higher than Sal did.
And then when he rescored, he still scored pretty low. He was a 7. And I noticed about 3 points that were lacking. And so the system has a process whereby you can submit kind of like a complaint form or a challenge form to say, I disagree with this. He has more stuff going on than he has acknowledged. And that really is what helped to get him quickly onto the radar.
Yeah, and we talked about the score before, Susan. It seems as like part of what is needed here is just a little bit more malleability, more ability to just take a look at the situation at hand and not rely on scoring like this.
And I think the emphasis for the 100-day challenge is to do precisely that. Nate knows far more people than Sal, and people are speaking up individually for people like that who would otherwise slip through the cracks. The system as it exists needs to be revamped. It needs to be more malleable. It needs to look at people individually.
And it needs to be revamped, and that may take time. I mean, what about the other Sals who are out there? I mean, what can happen for the other people to get closer to that challenge goal and get more people housing like Sal?
I think our ultimate hope is to kind of devise maybe like a two-tier system, if you will, where we have kind of a comprehensive outreach strategy and then a comprehensive housing strategy. Part of the challenge right now is the time from when people are becoming homeless or calling 211 and sort of entering the system to when these forms are being completed is very drawn out. And that's one thing that we're really trying to work on is cutting down that time so that if you were to call 211 tomorrow, first time calling, hopefully within a week, you would have all of these assessments done. And then that would mean that the housing side of the process would be able to very quickly then look at what is the best fit for you. Is it rapid rehousing? Is it supportive housing? Is it trying to move you into a roommate situation? I think that's really where we're trying to go with all this.
Susan, we just have about a minute or so left, but I have to say one of the most striking things about your story is that the place where Sal was sleeping, you said, was within view of the state capitol. And we were talking earlier in the program about transit-oriented development and how people at the state capitol are working on ways to get young people who are going to take the train into Stamford to live closer to train stations. And there is a bit of irony in Sal's story and just being able to see where all this talk is being done and he goes unnoticed.
And it's not that transit-oriented development is not important. It is important. And bringing young people into urban areas is very important. But we dare not, at the risk of all kinds of financial issues and moral issues, we dare not ignore the people who are sleeping outside or sleeping in shelters. It just makes sense to pay attention to them.
And I think also, Nate, it's the relatively modest numbers you're talking about, 100 homeless people to get homes, just a few people to get off the streets of Hartford. It may sound to people like that's a problem you could solve easily, but it is a hard problem to solve, and it takes a lot of resources.
Yeah, there are many steps in the process, many forms that need to be completed after those assessments are done. You have to prove someone's disability status. People aren't always willing and comfortable to share that. That was sort of the case with this story. Only certain trusted people will individuals disclose to in many situations. And then also we have to prove homeless status, which is incredibly challenging. If a person has stayed in a shelter once or twice and has spent most of the rest of their time couch hopping, sleeping in basements, sleeping outside, there are many steps to the process, and we're just trying to make it all neater for everyone.
And as Susan has reported for us earlier, just getting the documentation for people to just live as American citizens today is so difficult. I want to thank you, Nathan Fox, Director of Outreach Ministries at Center Church in Hartford, for joining us and telling us the story, but also for all the help that you've done in all of this project. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, man.
I also want to thank Susan Campbell, who's going to continue telling the story of Sal Pinafore. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
This segment produced by Katie Talarski. Our segment on transit-oriented development produced by Heather Brandon. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.